welcome to episode 40, I can still speak, of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Maureen Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I am fellow co-host, Ashley Lynch.
Miss Ashley, how go things?
Oh, things are going great. You know, they're crazy day in the rainy city of Vancouver today, which is
no kidding, right? You know, oh man.
I guess we're fully into spring now at this point, so this is what it's like. But yeah. It's nice. It's actually been pretty chill. So
it hasn't been too bad. But we're gonna forgo news this week because there were so many movies to talk about.
And there's no news. That's what you should take away from this. Absolutely nothing happened.
Exactly. Nothing has happened whatsoever. We're just going to talk about some movies. Let's do that. And why don't we talk about, we'll start with the movie that just opened this week, because we've both seen it. And that's Chris McKay's Renfield, which is, I guess, I mean, have they done this sort of take on Dracula before? Dracula through Renfield's eyes? I don't think so, right?
It's entirely possible because it feels like it's low-hanging fruit, but at the same time, I can't think of anything I can think of. And certainly not like this, where it's been done to, like, elevated to the level of an action film, essentially.
Oh, yeah. This is pretty much the thing. Okay, so the basic concept here is, well, the movie stars Nicholas Hoult and Nicolas Cage. Nicholas Hoult is Renfield. Nicolas Cage, of course, is Dracula. And Nick Hoult is trying to break free of, he's done with Dracula. He wants something new, but he can't because, you know, servant for life kind of thing. And then he gets involved with these weird ass people. There's like a gang called the Lobos, and there's a cop who's trying to take everybody down because that's just who she is. And like you say, it's more of an action movie than anything else. I'm kind of curious to hear what you thought about it because I have thoughts and I was not that entertained by this.
Really? Because I was incredibly entertained by it. I think this movie is a bit of a tonal tightrope because it is doing so many things where it's like trying to balance horror and comedy and action with some genuine character beats in this through line about a codependent character trying to break free from their narcissistic abuser, except it's like on the extreme end of that where their narcissistic abuser is like the Lord of Vampires who wants to take over the world. It goes to some really fun places and gets really gory in some places. And there was a lot of times where I just found myself laughing out loud with the film and just generally having a fun time. It seems to me like if you're really like dig the vibe of like Raimi's Evil Dead films or movies like that, then you're going to enjoy this one. It's going to be fun because it does go to those gory places. And it does, like, if you've ever wanted to see someone get stabbed with a severed arm, this is the movie for you. So that's exactly, you know, what you're going to get.
I agree. I think that for me, the best part of the movie is really the action. That I honestly think that's the only redeemable quality of the movie. There are truckloads of blood, not even bucket loads, truckloads of blood. Like, the bodies explode in glorious fashion. So, I mean, if this is exactly what you're looking for, this is the movie for you. Like you say, it's well within that, geysers of blood shooting out of everywhere trope. What I thought it would be funnier, I guess. Like, the trailer, I think, oversold this as the comedy. Yeah. And I knew from, like, the opening, like, 3 minutes when it opens with that the group session, and then there's a voiceover about the backstory. I'm like, okay, it's already fucking lost me because you've fucked up what you set up in the trailer. Like, you set up this sort of, like, almost mysterious setup that we all know what it is, but you're like winking at the crowd, and then you've just laid it all out. And I found the movie just really irritating in parts. Like, the story didn't work for me. I thought the comedy was lackluster. Awkwafina, I think, is fucking terrible here. Like, I don't even know what the hell is going on. She's so boring and so grating, and she can be so good. Like, yes, she has moments where she can be really grating, but she has shown potential to be good, and she's just wasted here. It's just like this, it's a terrible performance, and the character is just nothing here for me was like, wow, that's great. And I really did not laugh once. The only thing I truly appreciated were the fight sequences. And actually, I should say, I really did also like, I thought some of the transformations that Dracula goes into were really unique. Like stuff I hadn't seen before. Like the smoke thing I thought was really cool. Like that turned into smoke, blow you up from the inside. I'm like, oh, okay, I hadn't seen that before. That's pretty awesome. But the rest of it just felt kind of like super bland. I was so bored by this movie. At one point I was like, okay, is the action sequence almost over? Because I'm kind of ready for this movie to be done. I will also say the credit sequence with the like old movie style, like Universal Monsters credits was actually pretty cool. I thought that was a lot of fun.
I am honestly kind of surprised that we're almost exactly opposite on this. In fact, the only way in which we're not opposite on this film is the fact that I too like the action scenes.
Yeah.
I thought it was very funny. I like that they just sort of gloss over the stuff that we already know as audience members going into the story, and then just got into what was fun about this movie. And I thought the journey of Nicholas Holt's character of trying to break away from Dracula and assert a sense of independence and authority over his own life, it felt genuine and in enough in a movie that is not trying to be all about a dramatic journey of one character, because it has to pack in so much other stuff of being this hybrid genre film, but enough that I really enjoyed that story. And I thought Nicholas Holt was great. I enjoyed Awkwafina in this too, because she's just like, she's playing the, you know, really crass, over her head, badass, one good cop in a bad town sort of, you know, cliched situation. But it's exactly the kind of like the opposite that the film needs to Nicholas Holt's like really kind of refined sheepishness, where she is loud and crass and is, you know, not gonna take any shit from anyone. And he's the guy who's like meek and humbled and takes shit from everyone, you know. And it ends up, I thought, was a really good pairing. I thought the film was funny where it needed to be funny. It was not, I wouldn't call the movie scary at any point. The horror element it brings to it is basically just a lot of gore. My one criticism of the film, if I have a criticism, is actually potentially Nicolas Cage. Because while I think that he is good in the role as Dracula, and I enjoyed him in the movie, and I think he did a good job, it feels a little bit like a hat on a hat, because the rest of the film is doing so much already. When you add Nicolas Cage trying to like bring it up to 11 as well, it's like, it feels a little bit too much. And I enjoyed the scene. I most enjoyed the movie when he wasn't in it. I enjoyed the Nicholas Holt and Awkwafina characters together in that storyline, and him a little less so. And I can't help but wonder, like, again, I want to stress, I don't think he was bad in the movie. I enjoyed it a lot. But I can't help but wonder, in, like, another universe where you cast a legitimate heavy in that role that could be scary as Dracula and add, like, a real sense of kind of terror into the role rather than just being fun, if that would have balanced out the film even better a bit.
Yeah, like theoretically, I can see how it would work. For me, it just missed all the beats it needed to hit. I don't know why. Like, and that's the thing sometimes with comedy, right? Like, what works for some people won't work for others. And I tend to like, I like weird ass comedy. I will say that. Like, most people would be like, I'm not watching that. Hot Rod is still a classic in my books. But I don't know. It really didn't work for me. I was, of all the things that kind of disappointed me about this movie, and there were a lot, the thing I was probably most kind of irked by was I'm going to try to pronounce her last name, Audashlu, who is fucking amazing in everything.
See, I did not attempt to pronounce her name because I knew I would fail.
She is so good, and I would actually watch a prequel about how she came into power.
Oh, the most absolutely.
The most feared gangster family in the city. I'm like, oh, that's the movie I want to see next.
At the risk of sounding crass, I just want to luxuriate in a jacuzzi that is not filled with water, but just her voice. Because just being immersed in her voice is just so gorgeous and rich. And anytime that woman is in anything and she talks, I'm just like, I don't want to be anywhere else other than just listening to you say anything right now.
Yeah, we can agree on that. She's fabulous. I really love her. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't totally say, oh, don't go see that. It's terrible. I mean, it has some stuff that even I enjoyed. And for me, really, the action sequences are probably the height of the things to enjoy in this movie. But yeah, it was not for me. I was very disappointed.
It opens with a scene of what's his name, Ben Schwartz, running away from the scene of an accident with arms full of bricks of cocaine as cops are chasing him, and he yells back at them, I have a prescription for this. How can you not love this movie? It was so much fun.
Didn't work for me. I am the one person that it didn't work for, apparently.
C'est la vie.
It is what it is. Let's talk Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which has now been out for, I think, a couple of weeks. John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein's D&D movie, which we saw together and was a lot of fun.
We got to go see it in the theater together, and I always treasure when we can hit those
movies together. Yeah, me too. And, you know, for me, I actually really enjoyed this one. So it was, like, the action comedies of the last couple of weeks, this is the one that I would say is definitely more in line with my tastes. I love this movie so much. I thought it was so much fun.
Oh, I absolutely loved it too. And I was like, I was on the fence. I was trying to keep my expectations low because the directors, John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, they did the Vacation reboot, which I did not like at all.
It's so bad.
It doesn't work. But then they did Game Night, which I freaking love that movie. Game Night is so good.
Agreed.
And it's so creative, and it's like has this really fun subversive comedy to it. So I got excited about these guys doing a Dungeons and Dragons movie, but also be very tepid. Like, to prepare for this, I went back and watched like the 2000 Dungeons and Dragons movie. That movie is so god awful. Everything about that movie is horrible. The only part of the movie I liked is when one of the characters gets killed, because it's like, oh, finally, I don't have to suffer them anymore. It was just a disaster from beginning to end. And so it's like, I don't think Dungeons and Dragons as a film is an easy thing to adapt. There's like so many different directions with it, so many different things you could do, so many parts of the fandom that you could piss off with it. And I think they threaded that needle perfectly, and I think they made a great film that was really fun and is actually true to the game itself too, you know. And I mean, honestly, that's the thing that I'm most curious about, like when we're talking about numbers for this film, not like what it do for box office or, you know, what's going to be the final take worldwide or anything like that. It's going to be how many people who weren't playing tabletop games before are going to hunt out a tabletop game that they can join a campaign and play in because of this movie. Like, how many new game players is it going to convert because this movie got them into it? And to that forum, I've been seeing, like, the official, like, Dungeons & Dragons site, the D&D Online site. They've created, like, profiles for all of the characters to show, here's all their abilities, and here's where it links in the player handbook, and, you know, the weapons they use, and here's the spell that they were casting. So it gives people, like, an in into the game and how this plays. And I think it made for a great experience. This was like a fun movie that was on par with some of the best Marvel movies like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And honestly, I would watch this over a Guardians movie any day of the week, only because it's fresh and new and feels unique. Mm-hmm. The characters are not characters that at least I was familiar with. And I had a really good time. I mean, I haven't played D&D since high school, and even then I was not a like hardcore player by any means. I think I played twice in my entire life, and I'm not feeling the need to go and restart playing D&D now, but I certainly enjoyed the movie for what it is. But I was really curious about, you know, as someone that is way more into the lore than I am, and you and V had a really fun discussion about some of the Easter eggs that were peppered throughout for those hardcore fans. How do you think it kind of walks that line of being, you know, entertaining for fans and entertaining for non-fans? Because, I mean, as a non-fan, I would say this totally works. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a fun, epic, comedic action period drama, really, in essence.
I mean, like I say, I think it threaded that needle very carefully and very well and almost effortlessly. It doesn't feel like it's doing a lot of work to do that. I played D&D when I was a kid in, like, elementary school with some friends, and then just, like, you know, fell off and went and did other things. And then it was over the pandemic. I got together with some friends, and we started playing D&D again over Zoom calls, you know, because everyone's, like, locked up in their home, and that sort of continued. So for the last couple of years, I've been playing D&D for the first time since I was a kid and having fun with it. So it's interesting that this movie kind of coincides with that. And I think a lot of people have done that. I've talked to more than a few people who started playing D&D over the pandemic. So I think that's interesting. But this movie, it does a really good job of not needing to explain stuff. Like, I can think of a much lesser version of this movie where it's constantly having to say, okay, so we're going to have to do this thing, which is going to mean you have to cast this spell, and we have to blah, 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 blah. Instead, they don't really explain it to you. They just show it to you visually what's happening and count on the audience being quick enough on the uptake to just intuit what is happening. And it works. It totally works. And I think that was the right approach to go, because you could get really pedantic with adhering to the rule sets of the actual game or whatnot, and said, no, just do all that work behind the scenes and trust that the audience can keep up with it. And any stuff that they're not grokking, it will pass by and whatever. Someone else will pick that up. If you don't pick up this one thing, it doesn't matter. You can just go along for the ride. And the key beats of just, like, a fun adventure is there, whether or not you're sort of aware of, like, the greater sort of, like, you know, structure of Dungeons and Dragons that is around it. So it is a very delicate balance, and I think they absolutely nailed it.
I fully agree. I really enjoyed it. I was kind of primed to like it. Chris Pine kind of sold me on it from the get-go. But I was really, really impressed with just overall how fun it was, how good it looks, how quickly it moves. And it was just a lot of fun. I would watch this group adventure through the next whatever. No problem.
I'm hoping this is successful, and it's hard to know how they're going to define success, because this movie was a true co-pro where it was like Hasbro put up like half the money for this movie, and then Paramount like put up the rest. And so it's not just entirely on how much the studio makes about whether or not this thing continues. It's going to be depending on how much Hasbro really wants, like, to create, like, a Marvel Studios as part of their brand for Dungeons & Dragons. And I think that's going to depend on, like, how many new players did this create? You know, that's sort of why I touched on that earlier. I really hope that it's enough that they continue this and with this cast, because this was so much fun that I want to see, like, at least, like, three more movies with this cast.
Agreed.
It's or unless the movies start becoming bad, then, you know, then we can stop, but...
I will say I was actually surprised, because I didn't realize that at some point Hasbro had bought D&D. But once I saw that, I started looking around, and it just became more obvious that, okay, now it makes sense that a big company is actually putting some money behind this property. Because for the longest time, the only place to get anything D&D related, if you were looking for manuals, gameplay, whatever, you would have to go to the comic shop.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the only place you'd be able to get material, or you'd have to order it directly
from. Or like a specialty game store.
Yeah, exactly. But now it's like Chapters carries material, Walmart carries, like, there's books, entire like areas of shelving dedicated to D&D. So when I saw that Hasbro thing, I was both surprised, and then it all clicked together within the span of 20 seconds. I'm like, oh, this all makes so much sense now.
And with the website, they've got that all online too. Like how I've been playing is just like through that one website. I've got my character sheet on there. All the manuals are kind of linked online. I don't have to have any of that. I'm not even buying any of that stuff. The website's free too, up to a certain point. So it's like, I've done zero investment and have zero books sitting in my house to be able to play this game every week with my friends.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, we say Dungeons & Dragons. See it. It's good.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see it again.
Okay, we had a disagreement about this when we talked on After the Credits because, well, it just is what it is. Shazam Fury of the Gods. Mm-hmm. So this is the sequel to Shazam, directed by David F. Sandberg, who returns. And it literally picks up like where the first movie left off, where they've broken this thing. I can't even, what is it? A staff, I guess, of power.
The staff.
Yeah.
It's a wizard staff.
Yeah. It's a wizard staff that has, they've broken it and now there's like consequences to be paid. So the three sisters come to, you know, havoc and revenge and whatever all. And, you know, Shazam and his other Shazam buddies have to save the universe. That's basically Shazam in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I liked the first movie a lot. I really liked this movie too. I don't understand why people don't. I'm like, it is exactly the same as the first movie. It's kind of stupid. It's really fun. And it looks good. Like, what more do you want? What were you expecting for Shazam 2?
I am in total agreement with you.
Okay.
I'm glad you enjoyed this movie because I was ready to heap some love on it and have to defend it. I thought this movie was a lot of fun. I, too, really liked the first movie. Was kind of surprised at how much I liked the first movie. I really like the director, David F. Sandberg. Comes out of horror. He's like a true kind of, like, he's every independent horror filmmaker's, like, wet dream. In the sense that he got a career out of making a two-minute horror short film that went viral online, which then got adapted into making his first film, which was Lights Out. And then from there got pulled into the Blumhouse territory where he made one of the Annabelle prequels and then moved on to Shazam, where now he's like making these like $100 million superhero movies. And it's like, that is like the freaking dream right there. That's the lottery that every independent horror filmmaker dreams of. So, and he's also just a super nice dude too. We tweet each other every once in a while. So it's just like, you know, I have a lot of affection for the dude and I want to see him succeed. He's just a genuinely nice, you know, and generous guy. And so maybe I'm being a little bit biased in the fact that that helps me love Shazam, but I did genuinely love this movie. I think one of the problems people might have with this film is the first film is very much an origin story, and a lot of the fun that comes out of the first film is the fact of, like, here's this kid who just suddenly finds himself trapped in the body of a superhero and doesn't know how to deal and has to learn how to use it. And it's like, it spends a good, like, 45 minutes before he does anything superhero-y. The rest of it is just trying to, like, this out-of-body trying to figure out, like, what he's capable of and how to deal with this new existence sort of, you know, hijinks. And so because of where we end with at the end of that movie, that's not where our character is. Our character has a little bit better sense of, like, who he is and where he fits in the world. And that's where we sort of pick up. So you don't have that same kind of fun trying to figure it out hijinks that you have in the first movie. But in terms of, like, everything that this film delivers, I feel it was very much on par with the first film. I enjoyed it. There's a lot more horror aspects in this film than I was expecting, and I actually liked that. I think it was just as funny. I think it's a really entertaining movie. Has some great moments in it. I don't know. I adored this film. It's a lot of fun. I think people are being snobs.
I can't disagree. I think you're totally bang on. I'm like, I honestly don't understand how people watched the first movie and then watched and loved it, and then watched this one and went, not a fan. I'm like, why? It's basically the same fucking movie.
It is.
I don't get it. I don't.
I think the quality is about the same too.
Yeah. Oh, you know? Totally.
I don't feel like there's a big drop off between this movie and the first movie. It's like, whoa, they landed on something great, but did they lose it? No, it's a good movie. And I don't think this is an unfair apples to oranges comparison, but if you wanted to like pitch me, you know, Shazam Fury of the Gods or the Black Adam movie,
I'd take this
any day of the week.
You and me both. You and me both. I think
like overall, the fact that Rock threw his weight around and basically denied doing a Shazam cameo in Black Adam and denied doing a cameo in this movie, I think only helps this movie.
Yeah,
this movie is better for it.
I think so too. Like, I don't think it needs Black Adam. I'm disappointed that this might be the last one because I really do like these cast of characters. And
David Sandberg basically said online that like he's happy to head back and do horror and that he's done with superhero movies for a while. The fact that they like, I think it was like 30-day window and they put this on digital, they kind of gave up on this film pretty quickly. And it did not do the numbers that they were hoping to, unfortunately.
Which is too bad, because it really is a lot of fun.
It is.
Yeah. At least we have two really fun Shazam movies. Yeah. I will take them both. I am okay
with
that.
I think what bugs me is not so much that it didn't do so well financially at the box office, but that people seem to be like overly dismissive of the film. And for no reason at all.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I mean, there are great movies that don't make any money at the box office or that are financial disappointments. But again, like you say, there seems to be like a lot of hate. And I genuinely don't understand why, because I look at the two movies side by side and like they're like you say, like we're just rehashing it. The quality is exactly the same. It has the same tone. Like, it looks great. The acting is good. Like, I just don't understand. If anything, I think they really upped the ante here. There are some, like, visual things going on that are, you know, on par with anything that, you know, Marvel puts out. I don't understand why people are hating on it. Like,
and I think the characters are just really fun.
Yeah. Fully agree. Okay, yay! Watch Shazam, people.
Yes.
You won't be disappointed. Okay. Inside. This is Vasilis Katsoupis' new film. It's actually, I really didn't realize that was only his second film, because it's considering that it's like legit a one location movie.
Yeah.
Those are really hard to do and keep interesting. I'm always kind of impressed by filmmakers that even like take a stab at it, because it could so easily go sideways. The basic concept here is William Dafoe plays Nemo. He's a art thief who essentially gets locked up in this apartment when this art guy has like gone off to, I can't remember where, Saudi Arabia somewhere or Dubai or something. So they're going in to steal some art, except he never gets out.
Yeah, it's like a billionaire's like high tech penthouse suite with way too much security.
I'm curious to know what you thought of this.
Unfortunately, I was not a fan.
Yeah,
neither. Inside fits into this new subgenre that I call liminal horror, in which other movies I would sort of categorize in this as stuff like Skinamarink or Outwaters, where the entire thing is basically premised on here's a character in a location that they cannot remove themselves from, and that in and of itself is the horrific thing. There's nothing else really particularly horrible that happens to them in that environment, but that is the horror. And Inside has that sort of like it doesn't even really maintain it as a ticking clock, but it has that premise of he's a thief who's trapped inside a place that he's not supposed to be in, and he just needs to get out, and he's basically abandoned, and he's trying to get out of this apartment. And the thermostat's broken, so it's constantly getting hotter, and he's, like, desperately trying to keep himself hydrated and find some way to get out of this high-tech apartment. And it sustains itself for about 20 minutes. It's, I think, interesting for about 20 minutes. And I was hoping that, like, someone like Willem Dafoe, who is an incredible actor, could pull off this one-man performance. Unfortunately, nothing much really happens beyond what's in the first 20 minutes. It just sort of goes on. And this subgenre of liminal horror, I also kind of call the, some people really didn't fucking deal with COVID lockdowns well, and we're now seeing it play out in cinema form. Because that's what this is. If the idea of being locked in your house for 6 months at the beginning of COVID was, like, just destroyed you mentally, if you're the type of person who's, like, so extroverted and needs to get outside that it just, like, ruined you psychologically as a person, inside is going to speak to you really well. As for someone like me who's a lot more introverted, it's like, you know, I'm fine. I spend most of my time inside my studio working. This hasn't affected my life at all. Inside did nothing for me.
No, I was super disappointed, and I agree with pretty much everything you've said. And it's funny that you mentioned the 20-minute mark, because I think that that's exactly when I really started to lose interest. I'm like, okay, is anything else going to happen? Please let something else happen. And then it's just the same movie for another 40 minutes. It's just so grating and just so boring. And I was for like half of the movie, I was like, have I seen this before? Have I watched this movie before? I'm like, no, I just watched the trailer twice. That's all you need to watch. Just watch the trailer.
It's shot really well.
It's beautiful.
I think the production design is good. I think Willem Dafoe is doing a great performance.
Yeah.
But it's still a nothing burger of a film.
No, I fully agree. I mean, I even think the soundtrack is great. The score, I should say. The movie is just so bland. No thanks. No thanks.
Yeah, did not do it for me either.
All right, let's talk about Tetris, which is a movie that, if I remember correctly, we both really liked. So this is John S. Baird's new film, He of Filth and Stan and Ollie fame, starring Taron Egerton as Hank Rogers, who was basically the man that rescued Tetris out of Russia and in the process maybe brought Russia down for good. I don't know. It certainly seems that way.
Yeah, who knew that acquiring distribution rights for a video game could be so thrilling? But even though the movie is about Tetris, it's not like adapted from a video game. This is the true story of like all of these people who discovered Tetris and got so excited by just what a perfect video game it is. And when we look back on Tetris, it is kind of a perfect video game. Mm-hmm. And it was this piece of software that was written behind the Iron Curtain, and all these people globally who wanted to get their hands on it and distribute it because they knew it would make like endless amounts of money. But of course, this means dealing with communist Russia and trying to get the rights for something out of that country. And it turns into basically a Cold War espionage thriller where at the center is this one desperate software designer who has leveraged everything he owns on the promise that he can get the rights to Tetris and it will basically like completely change his life forever. And he genuinely believes in the game and how well it will do. And there's a whole bunch of other players that are at the table trying to get there first. And a country that is incredibly hostile and potentially willing to make foreigners just disappear if it gets to that point, you know. And I think they do a really good job at showing what Russia was like at this moment in time, because this is also the time when the Iron Curtain was about to fall. So Russia is in this incredible moment of political upheaval and is about to essentially fall apart. And as a result, it has created this whole breed of people inside the government that see this happening and know this is their moment to try to capitalize and get as much for themselves as possible before it all goes away, which creates a very kind of fraught moment for this one story about a video game to sit in. And I kind of loved it. It is a exciting and thrilling, but not overly oppressive and still kind of bouncy and fun movie. I thought they handled it great.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that I like best about Tetris is how it manages just to capture a period of time really, really well. And it unpacks some of that, like the complicated politics in this really easy, and I don't want to say breezy, but in this very digestible way that, you know, you get the broad strokes of what was happening at the time without really needing to get into the nitty gritty of it and still being able to grasp just how precarious the entire system was and how close to collapse it was already at that point. I really loved it. I thought it was great. I really like how it's a story about people first, which I think is why it works so well. And Taron Egerton is a really, really solid actor. I don't think he really gets enough credit. I mean, yeah, he gets the nominations, but I don't think that he deserves to be more of a star than he is. Because he's I think he kind of
I don't want to say disappeared into this role, but he wasn't identifiable in the way that he seems to be in a lot of the other films I've seen him in. It really felt like he sort of like became a character in this movie rather than which is playing Taron Egerton.
I could go with that. So this is now streaming on Apple. So if you have Apple TV, it's definitely one worth checking out. I'm with you. I really, really liked it. I'd highly recommend it to anybody. I think I've already recommended it to a bunch of people. So
yeah,
definitely one worth watching. And I didn't do this on purpose, but just accidentally, the next film is actually very, very similar in that it's a movie. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Air, which is also a movie about something that you
rights
would never
acquisition,
think. Yeah, right. It's not something that you would think, oh, that'll be really interesting, but it turns out to actually be really interesting. And this is Ben Affleck's return behind the camera to tell the story of the Air Jordan and how the Air Jordan sneaker came to be, which sounds like, why would that be interesting? And it's really fucking interesting, okay? I really, really like this movie. I mean, I'm not against sports movies, but they're generally not my favorite. And technically, this isn't really a sports movie. It's more of like a sports adjacent, I think is the term we came up with. So Matt Damon stars as Sonny Vaccaro, who was basically a recruiter at Nike in the early 80s. And it was basically the time of the sneaker wars. Adidas, Converse had the corner of the market on basketball sneakers and the culture, really. And Nike was this fledgling company that was already making like millions of dollars, but they were like the white person shoe that people wear to run. Like all of their money was from running shoes. And this is kind of the story of how Nike became revolutionary again, because of this, it really changed not only the landscape for basketball shoes, but it really changed the cultural landscape for, you know, suburban wear, I guess you would call it. And it's really good. Like, the acting is great. It's really well shot. It's really engaging. It moves really well. And, you know, for literally a bunch of guys sitting around talking about making a fucking shoe, it is really, 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 really entertaining. And Viola Davis plays Michael Jordan's mother. She's basically the only woman in this movie, so it's worth mentioning. And she's quite good. So I would say that this is definitely one to add to your watch list. It is an Amazon film, so it's going to end up on the streaming platform probably in a week or two. But I did make it out to the theater to see it, and I'm not disappointing I did. It's really fun. I highly, highly, highly recommend it.
I'm going to wait for streaming for this one. It's just like the schedule's too packed. Had Renfield this week. Evil Dead Rise comes out next week, and there's no way in hell I'm going to not see that movie in theaters. So it's I'll wait until this hits Prime, but I am interested. I really liked Argo, and so when Ben Affleck makes movies, I'm actually genuinely interested.
Yeah, me too.
What he makes, so.
And honestly, I consider just waiting because I'm like, oh, it's not a big action movie. Do I really want to go see that in theaters? You don't need to see it in a theater. I would recommend just, you know, adding it to your watch list and, you know, catching up with it at some point because it is really worth a watch. And Affleck does make an appearance as, and it's more than an appearance. He like plays a pretty pivotal role as Phil Knight. And I think he nails it. Because Phil Knight is this weird guy. Okay. And he's just kind of like very eccentric. And Affleck, I think, is so good in the role. So good. But the performances are fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. Highly recommend it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Let's talk a little bit about Money Shot, the Pornhub story, which is streaming on Netflix. This is Suzanne Hillinger's documentary about Pornhub. I'm curious to know what you think about this one because I started it and for whatever reason I didn't finish it. So I've only seen half of it at this point.
I think this documentary is interesting, but with caveats. I mean, just off the front, I would say this is a Netflix doc. So the fact that they did not decide to say, hey, can you make this like a 4-part miniseries?
Shocking.
Instead of just a single doc. It's like, kudos. That's the right direction to go, Netflix. Please. Thank you. I'm going to guess that's because they acquired it and didn't just like produce it out of the gate. However, I had read a fair amount in reaction to this documentary from some very knowledgeable people in advance of seeing it. And I was kind of glad that I went in forearmed with a certain amount of information. I think there's a lot of good stuff in this documentary. I think ultimately this doc, which basically it dives into Pornhub and some of the problems that Pornhub has, the reaction to Pornhub, and it generally does so from the perspective of sex workers that rely on Pornhub to basically earn a living. And in that, I think it is generally pretty good. The part where the documentary bothers me on an ethical level is that it gives a lot of line and legitimacy to various advocacy groups who oppose Pornhub and are basically fighting against Pornhub for what they say are very legitimate reasons. But when you dig into it, and the doc does eventually dig into it and pull this curtain back, are revealed to just be religious right-wing organizations that want to define everything as pornography. They want to define Cosmopolitan magazine as pornography and have it banned. And they're approaching it from a we need to save children from exploitation angle, but their ultimate goal is just to end pornography entirely. And the documentary gives a lot of legitimacy to these organizations that if you only watch the first half of the documentary, they seem entirely reasonable. And it isn't until you get towards the end that it's like, oh, by the way, here's some real troubling caveats about the people we just let talk to you for like a half hour of this documentary. And that I think was really troubling. I don't know if that was a case of not having enough material to fill out a full doc. I think it is interesting stuff, but it goes a little bit too far in presenting both sides and does not do so with full transparency. And that's the real kind of troubling part. Other than that, as long as you go in forearmed with that knowledge and watch it, I think there is a lot of interesting stuff in this documentary and it is worthwhile.
Okay, that's good to know. I probably will finish it. I was actually hoping, I think I forgot, to be honest. I started it at some point, then got sidetracked. And I'm like, oh, I'll go back to finish it. And then totally forgot until I saw it on your list. So I'll make the effort to finish it. Now I'm really curious to see. Maybe I didn't even get halfway at this point. I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. I think it is a story that is worth exploring, even if this documentary does not do the best job of exploring it.
It's certainly a story worth telling. But I think there's
enough good here.
Yeah, that's good. I caught up with A Good Person, which is Zach Braff's new movie. I'm not quite sure. I know the reason that I watched this, and the reason I watched this is Florence Pugh, who's amazing in everything at this point. I'll probably watch, if she like cooked for 3 hours, I would watch her cooking for 3 hours. Like, I'll just watch her in anything. She's very, very engaging. And
especially if she did it with a moose and squirrel accent.
There you go. But in all honesty, she is pretty much, I think, the only reason to watch this movie. It's a very, very, very straightforward story about a woman dealing with substance abuse as a result of a tragedy in her life. And I mean, it's played for like capital D drama. And I guess maybe it, like, I just don't think it earns it. Like, the movie is just very, I think, meddling. It doesn't really give us anything new. It's not, you know, uncovering any new insight into tragedy and into drug abuse and into recovery. Like, there's none of that. And it only really works because Florence Pugh is really watchable. It's just very mediocre. Like, I was expecting more, especially for all the drama that was made about the movie. It's a very, very sort of middle of the road drama. And I feel bad saying don't watch it because, I mean, Florence is really good. There's just nothing particularly great here other than her.
Mm.
And that's just the sad reality of it. There just isn't that much more here.
I hadn't really heard anything about this movie, and then I saw it came out, and I was like, it all just looked very vague, and so I just sort of glossed over it.
Yeah, and that's probably the correct reaction because there really is not much to dig into here. That's just the sad truth of it. I made a special trip to the movies. I was sold by an Instagram ad. It's true. Believe it or not.
Sometimes, ads sometimes, work. That's what you're hearing.
Pretty much. Ads sometimes work. I had seen a trailer for this. I knew it was coming out, but it's a very small Canadian film. And the film I'm talking about is Simulant. Small Canadian movie directed by April Mullen, who has been making movies since, like, I don't know, the early 2000s, maybe earlier. I first saw Rock, Paper, Scissors, The Way of the Tosser, and Gravy Train are both kind of in the same vein where there are these action comedies, like very low budget Canadian action comedies. They're very much of like a particular time when there were a bunch of these movies coming out. And at the time she was working pretty exclusively with Tim Dorian, who I think is a partner, a very least production partner. And they co-directed the first movie, and then she kind of broke out on her own and he started like sort of writing and producing, and she exclusively directed films. And she's been doing a lot of TV, and I hadn't realized how much TV she'd been doing, because to me this felt a little bit like out of her comfort zone, because the only things I've seen her do are basically action comedies and then romantic comedies. Yeah, a lot
of action TV.
Yeah, but she's been doing a lot of action TV and a lot of sci-fi, so this kind of falls into that train. So the story behind Simulant, it's very like standard sci-fi fare. The concept here is we're in the near future where clones and robots are, and AI is kind of like an everyday thing. And everybody pretty much has like a robot helper around the house with some level of AI. And it follows Robbie Amell and Jordana Brewster, who are a married couple. And there's some drama that happens there. And then there's this other story, which is kind of the central story, where you have Sam Worthington as an agent who is basically tracking down AIs that have like gone off the grid. So they've become disconnected from their owners and they're now living as like passing themselves off as human when in fact they're clones, they're robots. So there's these multiple stories going on. Simu Liu is also here. He plays like this scientist that is maybe trying to rescue all the sentient robots. I don't know. The story itself is a little bit metal. Like, there's just a lot going on, and there's some excessive characters and storylines that don't really need to be there. They don't add anything to the overall story. But, like, the movie is actually looks really good. The visual effects are surprisingly great considering it's a low-budget Canadian movie. And it's really, like, a fun watch. I really did enjoy it. I just wish that there was a little more tightness to the script. But overall, I think it's definitely worth checking out. I'm assuming at some point very soon it'll end up on some streaming service. I believe it's also a Crave production, so it'll turn up on Crave on demand at some point very soon. But I wanted to make sure I mentioned it because it is actually, like, pretty decent. It's been a while since I've seen a really good Canadian movie. So, hey, I'm putting this one down. This is one to watch.
Well, I'll definitely be sure to check that one out. This one passed by me.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So thank you. Thank you, Instagram ad. I'm like, oh, it's playing? Where? Okay, I'll go. I have nothing else to do with my life. I also caught up with Boston Strangler, which is Matt Ruskin's, I guess, kind of biopic on the two women, the journalists that helped to capture the Boston Strangler. And I say help because, well, okay, so this gets complicated for anybody that knows anything about the Boston Strangler, because they thought they had the guy in custody, but maybe they didn't. And it's actually still an unsolved mystery at this point. Who knew? But that's besides the point, really. The real story here is Loretta McLaughlin and Jean Cole, who were these two reporters that were basically investigative reporters at the time when women didn't do this. Like, most women were still homemakers that didn't even work outside of the home. And here are these two women that are basically pushing the police force in Boston to do their job, because they really were lackadaisical and nobody was talking to each other, and murders were continuing to happen when they could have been prevented if the police forces had talked to each other. It's not like a particularly, like, you know, flashy movie, but it's really well made. And Keira Knightley and Carrie Coon are really, really engaging. They're both great actresses and they put in solid performances here. The movie is streaming on Disney Plus. It's a Starz production, I guess. Fox, sorry. But it's under the Starz label on Disney. And it kind of came very quietly. They released it and there was a little bit of press around it when it was, like, dropped a couple of weeks ago, but it's been kind of falling by the wayside. But I finally caught up with it and I thought it was quite good. I would really recommend it. It's a good watch. Just a solid drama.
Okay.
Should we talk about some TV?
Yeah, let's.
Let's start with Pretty Baby, Brooke Shields. That's the
I just title. Have a couple things I've seen, but
yeah.
Pretty Baby is a two-part doc series that basically just examines Brooke Shields' career as a child actor, and specifically through the lens of how sexualized Brooke Shields was as a child, and our culture at a time, both how that affected her, how that affected the culture at the time that was sexualizing her, and how that kind of helped shape the culture we're in now. Because the film kind of posits that while Brooke Shields was far from the first young woman who was ever sexualized in the history of ever, she was kind of like this prototypical giant celebrity for being a sexualized child, especially in the 80s and late 70s. Blue Lagoon was a huge movie in which she was essentially underage and naked in the film, and that kind of continued through a certain part of her career and how that kind of overshadowed who she was trying to be and caused a lot of difficulties in her life. The doc is, I think, really interesting. it delves into a lot of stuff, especially because I've never really sort of gone back and self-interrogated, like, where did Brooke Shields really sit in our popular culture at the time? You know, all the while being very much aware of her, like, being this figure, you know, because I was a child when she was in most of these movies. So Brooke Shields was just always, like, this huge sort of, like, young celebrity that was around. And it's really neat to go back and sort of interrogate that entire thing through a modern lens and look at, like, how, I don't want to say specifically just how harmful, but harmful is a good word for it. How she was treated and how she was integrated into popular culture at that age. I just found the doc really fascinating all around.
I thought it was really good, too. I'm still surprised that, I mean, when I saw that it was a limited series, I expected it was going to be like 6 episodes. And it's 2 episodes and they're both an hour each. I'm still not sure why it's not just a 2-hour doc, but whatever, that's semantics.
They did the same thing with that doc, Phoenix Rising.
Yeah.
The Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah.
One where it was a Sundance thing and they split it into 2 parts.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually thought, I think you're right, like, turning the camera to Brooke Shields and kind of examining that period of time and what happened to her in conjunction to what's happening now with social media, I think is really interesting. I actually found the second part of the doc, and particularly like the last 20 minutes when she's having these conversations with her 2 daughters who are teenagers, talking about, social media. Yeah, and the fears and how you kind of have to have like that self-awareness of what you're putting yourself, like what you're doing and putting out there. I thought that was a really interesting conversation, and I thought that the route to get there was interesting as well. I maybe didn't like it quite as much as you did, but I still thought it was a really fascinating look at, again, a period in the culture and how it's affected where we are today. I think that's more interesting than the fact it's a documentary about Brooke Shields. Though that in and of itself is also pretty interesting because she is not somebody that, like, even though she was sort of part of the culture always, like, it seems like we've always had Brooke Shields, even though at some point she didn't exist. But yeah. I never considered what that meant for her as an individual. And I think that's scarier. And for me, that's kind of what I was thinking about. I'm like, what other, you know, particularly women in that period of time, do we just like sort of write off and not really consider as human beings? Because it tends to be like we think of a lot of the actors and the men as, you know, I don't know, they seem to have like a different power. And a different, like, you talk about them differently than you do a lot of the women. So I thought that for me was pretty interesting. So overall, I agree. I think it's a really, really interesting watch.
One of the things I really liked about this doc, and I've had a really difficult time articulating this, so sorry about that. But one of the things that I particularly dug about this is in dealing with the stuff when she was, like, particularly of a young age. And there's all these people trying to interview young Brooke Shields to almost get like a gotcha to find out that she's being like an abused child or something like that. But what the doc makes very clear, like, even though it's saying like the industry kind of sexualized Brooke Shields and put this on her, but at the same time, it doesn't deny her agency at any point in her life to the point where she's a child who didn't know this was happening to her. No, she knew exactly what it was, and she was okay with it because it allowed her to do the things that she wanted to do and work at a level that she wanted to work at. And as a child, you can sort of see it in every interview that she's in, that she's like, was always obscenely mature, not in body, but in mind.
Yeah.
About her position. And it never really felt like she was necessarily a quote-unquote victim of the system, but more that her and her mother were okay with going up to a certain limit that other people may not have been okay with. And in some cases, that meant, like, you know, freely exposing one's body to the camera.
Yeah.
But I think it is really important that they do portray a young preteen Brooke Shields as very much having agency over her own life and her own career.
Yeah, and I fully agree with that. And I think that that's one of the things that they do really, really well is they never discredit what she did and why she did it. Like, it was always very clear that she had some semblance of control over what was happening, even if she might not always... like, there are scenes where you kind of get the sense that if she had to do it differently, she would, like, if she had to do it again, she would do it differently. Like, there's, especially when she's talking about her mom and some of the things that happened there. But, like, it never felt like she was forced into anything unwillingly. And I think you nailed something, this idea that, you know, you had all of these mostly men doing interviews, trying to catch her saying something stupid or, you know, giving something up. And you never get that. And that's nope. So true with a lot of young actresses in general. Like Jodie Foster, when she was kind of like in her Raging Bull days, and, you know, Natalie Portman and some of the performances that she did when she was younger. Like, you always get these interviews where you have these people trying to, you know, trip them up or something. Like, and it's so skeezy. It just... And you don't really think about it at the time, and you look back on it now and you're like, ew, that's worse.
It's very kind of, I don't know, like patronizing and condescending and infantilizing. And I get it. She's an actual child. And, like, you know, you're going to expect a certain amount of interrogation about, like, how involved she is in the decision to do some of the things that she's done. But she makes it very clear that, like, that was the decision of her and her mother. And they, you know, she did what she wanted to do. And, you know, she knew what she was getting into and she was fine with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent, Doc. I agree. I think it's definitely one worth watching.
Yeah.
The Night Agent. Now, I have to preface this by saying I've seen half of the series. I probably will finish it because I am really enjoying it. So now go at it.
Okay. I shotgunned the show pretty quick. It's a fun show. But it's also not like the most incredible thing you're going to see. It's a fun piece of pulp is what it is. I believe it's based on a novel, or if it's not, it really feels like it's based on a novel, the kind that you would see in, like, a supermarket checkout line. And the whole premise is basically there's, like, at the White House, there's this night agent office where this disgraced FBI agent who's trying to work his way back up the ladder after surviving a terrorist bomb attack that some people think he was responsible for just by virtue of him being there. And he's manning this phone, which is just supposed to be this phone at which, like, deep cover operatives basically call when they're in trouble and, you know, give a code word and then they get, like, you know, support. And we are introduced to this other character, a woman who it just happens to be staying with her aunt and uncle, doesn't know her aunt and uncle are spies, and then someone, you know, basically assassinates them. And before this, she is told, get to the house down the hill and call this phone number and give them this code word. And so by virtue, it puts this Boy Scout FBI agent with something to prove next to this woman who assassins are coming after and is headstrong and doesn't trust anyone. And we go on the, we're being chased by everyone and we don't know who inside the system is corrupt and this might go up as high as the president and, you know, that type. We've all seen this before. But it is a fun one of those. You know, it is enjoyable, but nothing to overly write home about.
Yeah,
so if you're looking for a fun Sunday afternoon goofy spy thriller, this is good.
Yeah, I've enjoyed what I've seen of it so far, and I do plan on finishing it. I just haven't gotten around to it. I really like the, I apologize, I should have written it down. I really like the guy that plays the main agent kid. He's very charming, and he's very watchable.
Gabriel Basso.
He's pretty good. He's pretty good, and actually, I think everybody in the series is, you know, pretty decent. And I've enjoyed what I've seen so far, so I'll definitely plow through the end of it for sure.
I mean, who I particularly loved is Hong Chau is in here, is basically the main character's boss, and she just seems to be everywhere all at once now.
Yeah,
like I think the first time I ever saw her was probably The Menu. I mean, I'd seen her in other stuff, but I hadn't really noticed her in other stuff. And then with, like, The Menu, I'm just like, oh, shit, I like her. And then now it's just suddenly she seems to be everywhere. She's in The Whale. She's in this. And for some reason, they're trying to convince us that she's, like, 60 years old in this show.
Which makes no sense. Who's buying that?
But I'm with it anyways. I dig her gray hair look. I'm on board.
Yeah, I like her in general.
But yeah, apparently this is the year of Hong Chau, and I kind of love her. And apparently she is just going to be everywhere, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, me too. I'm there with you. I wanted to mention this because, it's interesting. And for a show that's not really about particularly, like, interesting, it actually has, like, a really revelatory moment in one episode where I was like, okay, if it's worth it for only this one moment, it's worth it. So it's Tiny Beautiful Things, which is the new production from Hello Sunshine, so Reese Witherspoon's production company. This is based on a novel by Cheryl Strayed, who also wrote Wild, which Reese Witherspoon was in. So, you know, hence the connection. This stars Katherine Hahn, and it's streaming on Disney. And it's basically about this this woman who has a husband and a daughter. A series opens with her having taken $15,000 out of her daughter's university fund to give to her brother, who is basically a drug addict with problems. And then from there, you start to kind of get it jumps back and forth between her life now and her youth and the relationship she had with her mother and with her brother. And you get like lots of drama with a capital D. The episodes are about 30 minutes long. I think that they would call this a dramedy because it does have some comedic moments, but it really is a drama. And you know, the other part to this is that she is she put out a book like 10 years ago that was very successful. She hasn't really written anything since. She is working this kind of like dead end job. And a friend of hers who is in writing gives her this opportunity to basically answer. It's almost like a Savage Love column where people will send in their problems, and then, you know, she will write these responses. And they turn out to be these really insightful essays for every week. And there's, I think, 8 episodes in total. And in episode 7, she has this revelation where she's talking like somebody. The episodes always start with she's reading the emails that people have submitted. And then the story unfolds with the backstory that will help her write the essay for that week, I guess. But in episode 7, there's this very key moment where she writes in her essay that wanting to leave is enough reason to leave. So basically this concept that wanting to do something is enough permission to just do it. Like, you don't need any other reasons to do things that you want to do other than wanting to do them. And she is writing this in response to this woman who is, you know, trying to find reasons to do things. And I thought that sort of like, for whatever reason, that little tidbit of information was like, huh, that is not something that we talk about very often. We're always looking for reasons to do things. Wanting to do something should be enough reason to do it. And I'm like, okay, if I took nothing else away from this series, that nugget is worth it. You don't really need to watch the rest of it. I mean, Katherine Hahn is really great, but the rest of the series is like, it's fine. I mean, It's not great. It's not terrible. It just is what it is. But that nugget of information is kind of like gold. I'm like, okay, if nothing else, I took that from it. And I'm okay with it.
That's great. I mean, sometimes that's all you need. Like an entire movie or series can be worth it if there's just like this one little thing in it that speaks to you.
Yeah, and the rest
can be unremarkable. There are plenty of films and shows that I sort of keep with me just because of that, because there's this one thing where it's like, yes, that one little piece.
Yeah. So I think perhaps other people might take similar nuggets from some of the other episodes. So I don't want to write the whole thing off in like one big swath. It's just, you know, it's not particularly remarkable, but it does have these sort of like little nuggets of information every episode, which I think is, you know, it makes it really worth watching. And they're only 30 minutes, so it's not a huge time investment, but it's pretty solid, pretty solid. And I wanted to finish with the series that I pretty much watched in one sitting.
Oh my God.
And that would be Beef. Holy shit. Leave it to A24 to put out their very first series and it'd be like a knock out of the ballpark. So it stars Ali Wong and Steven Yeun. And it opens with, well, it doesn't really open here, but the whole idea of the beef. And we're talking about like a beef between two people that, you know, are having a disagreement. It's basically a traffic incident gone horribly, horribly wrong. She basically cuts him off as he's backing up out of a parking spot and gives him the finger.
It's a minor inconsequential.
Totally minor. And he loses his shit.
Which doesn't even result in an accident or anything like that.
Nothing. And it just turns into this chase that just then grows into this enormous clusterfuck of these two people that whose lives continue to be intertwined because of this traffic infraction.
It's basically two people with like disturbingly deep-seated anger that is seething under the surface and looking for an outlet to unleash it upon, and they find each other.
Pretty much. Yeah, this is pretty much it. And for the most part, it's literally like this, just the story of these two people who live very, very different lives that have this one thing in common. And occasionally that thing keeps bringing them into contact with each other. And then the final episode is this completely like esoteric weirdness with like, it's just weird, but it really, really works. I just don't want to give away any details because it's so bizarre. And you're like, what is happening? This series just went sideways. And you're like, oh yeah, no. Okay. I can totally go with this. I'm here with you. I'm here with you. It is also happens to be like the greatest soundtrack of the 90s that I have experienced in so long. I literally just want the Spotify playlist on repeat. It is like the best encapsulation of a period of my youth that I'm like, every song, I'm like, Jesus, whoever wrote this clearly knew me in high school.
I've only watched the first episode of this so far. I keep meaning to go back and finish it. I think one of the things that semi bothered me about the show is like, I saw the trailer, I was like, okay, that looks interesting. I'm in with this. It seemed very similar to me. There was a movie back in the early 2000s with Ben Affleck and Samuel Jackson called Changing Lanes.
Yes.
Where the entire premise is they get into a car accident on the freeway and it negatively impacts Samuel Jackson's life because they get to like a child custody hearing and Ben Affleck runs off because he's late for another thing. And because they're two angry dudes, they both start fucking with each other back and forth, getting revenge until it basically just like threatens to destroy both of them. And this seems like it's a very similar premise. And I love the two leads. I love Ali Wong. I love Steve Yeun. you know, what's not to love here? I think my only real kind of disappointment was, like, when I found out, like, oh, this is a series, it's not a movie. And then I watched the first episode, and at the end, I was like, okay, I'll give it... I don't know how down I am for a full series of this, but we'll give it an episode and see if it hooks me. And the first episode, while it's good, did not really sink its hooks into me that deeply. And I want to finish the show. I'm going to go back and finish the show. Everyone's raving about it right now. So I am committed to watching this thing. But, God, it's another one of those Netflix things where I can't help but wonder, like, should have this been a movie instead of a series?
I honestly don't know if they could have done it as a movie. It's because it's quite long. I think it's 7 or 8 episodes at least, and they're each 30 minutes long. And honestly, if you turn this into a movie, I don't know where you would cut. Like, everything feels maybe not essential to the main story, but you get to know the characters. Like, by episode 2, they start introducing a bunch of other characters that become sort of, like, essential to the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know where you would cut somebody off. And can I say Maria Bello is so good here. I haven't seen her in a long time, and she is just like, she's a total riot. And it's of course, as you're dealing with this beef between these two people, you also get an insight into who they are as individuals and their own personal struggles. And both of their stories are really, like, relatable and charming. And I think it's funny that Ali Wong kind of walks this, because she's very funny. I mean, she's a stand-up comedian. Yeah. But she is more relatable here than I've seen in probably any of her stand-up.
Well, she's also played a genuinely kind of sociopathic person
in
this show.
She comes across as, like,
very unhinged.
Very unhinged, but sort of like this unhinged in the, like, there's the, like, the Instagram white lady, right? Yeah. Like, with the hat, and she has, like, a very specific lifestyle, but she happens to be this Asian woman that has all of these other pressures on top of that, including the fact that she's basically the only she's the sole breadwinner in the family. Okay, I won't say anything more. It's just super, like, with every episode, you get, like, deeper and deeper into the shit of it, and you're like, holy crap, what is happening? And I'm sure there is, like, some deeper meaning to the episode titles and the artwork at the beginning of every episode. I haven't figured out what it is, and I haven't read anything about it, but I plan to, because I know there's something there. I'm going to turn into one of those crazy people that, like, overanalyzes anything of the show, because clearly there's a hidden meaning.
All right, I am committed. I'm going to watch the rest of the series, and I will report back.
Yeah, we could talk more next time. And that is a lot of stuff, but that is it.
That's a lot of stuff, and we expect you to watch it all.
All of it, except for maybe, what didn't we like?
We didn't Inside.
Yeah, so,
we were split on Renfield, but other than that, we seem...
Yeah, in agreement.
Pretty in agreement about, which is nice.
For sure. There's a few things coming out in the next couple of weeks. Like you said, the new Resident Evil is coming out.
Resident Evil.
Shit, sorry.
Oh my God, do not slight me like that. Evil Dead Rise.
I know.
The good series, Evil Dead Rise. I'm so looking forward to this. I am, for people who don't know, I am a complete nutbar for the Evil Dead series. Evil Dead 2 was the movie that made me want to make movies for a living, because I loved it so much. So this series is, like, hugely important to me. So I'm so excited.
I like Armory of Darkness. That's my personal fave out of the bunch.
Can't help. That's myself. A great movie too.
It is. They're all pretty. Like you say, they actually are pretty good. So I apologize. Yep. What was I thinking? But there's a couple of things coming out in the next couple of weeks, and we'll be back to talk about them soon. So, in the meantime, I almost forgot. You can check out links to all of the things we talked about at atcpod.ca. And Ashley, where can people get in touch with you if they want to at you?
People can at me on Twitter, at Ashley Lynch. While that site still exists.
Yeah, and you can find me on Twitter as well, at The Marina. I do reply to @s, but I'm not on Twitter as often. You will find me posting quite regularly on Instagram at The Marina too. We'll link to all of that in the show notes. And until the next one.
Insert catchphrase here.
opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.